So, warm welcome to everyone. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah. So, if you can at some point, please raise your hand and get my attention. So, what a beautiful evening. Amazed that so many people were inside listening to me with this kind of weather. A teacher I really like says, linger in it. You know, it's like when you really have pleasant moments, eat them up. Just savor them. It uplifts the heart. So the title of the talk tonight kind of evolves. I was proposing a course, and initially what you do at the center is I make a list, a whole bunch of things I'm interested in teaching, and then the center says, well, you can do these. And I think the initial title is Mindfulness is Not Enough, because everybody's going around saying, be mindful, be mindful, be mindful. And I've had a real hang-up. My wife says I don't have any obsessive bones in my body, but actually I have a few. And one of them has to do with this word mindfulness. It's interesting for me, in the Zen tradition, you just never hear the word. In the Soto Zen, one simply sits and is aware of the posture, and some kind of wisdom arises from that. Or in the Rinzai Zen, you go in and the Zen master asks you a question that doesn't have any intellectual answer. And if you try and give him one, it just rings a bell and sends you off until you come back and be able to manifest something in a moment without a thought process. So it just cuts this thinking mind out of the picture, which isn't that the source of most of our problems, really? You know, the thoughts, the emotions, the I we construct. So part of the reason I have a hang up about this word mindfulness is that it's seeped out of this tradition into mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. You can find magazines on airplanes at the checkout counter on mindfulness will give you a flatter abs or something like that. I mean, it's become like a kind of a cure-all for every possible problem you might ever have. So I thought maybe I'd just, and I do apologize, I'm a little bit obsessive about this, but the reason I think it's worth talking about what this word mindfulness refers to is that I was here for a long time practicing, and certainly because a lot of it was in Zen, I just didn't really think about the structure of this particular tradition. And also I'm a delusional type, so people were probably teaching me things that I didn't quite get them. But I really had a lot of insights or realizations, whatever language you want to use, but I didn't really know what the structure of this practice is. So what I'd like to do tonight is sort of give some framework that what we're really doing here. I taught the elders group, I guess, I don't know, a few weeks ago, and I said, so what are you doing sitting here? Which is a good question, I think. I don't know. When we come in here, I want to touch on that. So a couple of definitions that float around, and I don't mean to criticize these definitions, because trying to define something as complex as mindfulness in a sentence or two is a setup for you, right? But so mindfulness is a translation of Pali word sati. And a woman named Sabine Selassie, who's a Zen teacher, said it's a translation of word sati that was done in Victorian era. Very conceptual. How about heartfulness, bodyfulness? So it kind of conveys something that gets to be heady, and really our practice is to be aware of not just the thinking mind but really something has a quality of empathy and being embodied. And really the essence of this practice in some ways is to be embodied. It's our ground. So I think if you walked out of here with no other focus but just to be embodied, because that really helps you quiet down the mind. And part of the sitting practice is to do that more, whether it's with the breathing process or body scans or a whole bunch of techniques that are to help us settle down. So John Kabat-Zinn, who really kind of took this tradition and developed mindfulness-based stress reduction, defines mindfulness something like paying attention in a particular way on purpose without judgment. So that leaves a lot of kind of questions here, like, well, in what particular way? But attention has to do with focusing on something. And the non-judgmental thing is a little tricky because sometimes you don't want to be judgmental, but sometimes you can sort of say, well, this is not so good. You know, so with people who are dealing with things like depression or anxiety, part of what the non-judgment points to is not saying I shouldn't have depression, not adding a whole story to it, but actually being with the raw sensations of it. That's part of what this non-judgmental thing means. And by being with the experience, the raw experience, some of these patterns get freed. They're not so overwhelming. So, okay, there's anxiety, and the practice is some ways to just be embodied and let anxiety be here. And we'll see that at some point it goes away. Hopefully, I think, if you pay attention enough. And so that's sort of a kind of way of kind of deconstructing some of the charge of these things, whether that's anger, whatever. Andrew Olzensky, who's teaching some courses here on the weekend, gives a similar definition, but he uses the word equanimity rather than without judgment. And equanimity means a lot in this tradition, but maybe roughly it means something like don't push away the experience, or don't reach for new experiences, just to open to things without pushing or pulling away. And by the way, I have sort of questionable feelings about the note thing, but these talks are put up on cimc.dharmaseed in a few weeks, so you can find them there if you want. The person who really influenced my notion of a framework for this practice was a monk, a Western monk by the name of Ajahn Tanissaro. He's given some talks from here to time to time. And he gave a talk here, and I thought, oh, there's a structure to practice. And I've been doing it for a long time and gotten a lot of freedom, but it was really helpful. And there's actually an article, if you just search for Food for Awakening, it really lays out that framework, I think, very clearly. But it's I mean, I'd say take what you can out of it because it goes pretty deep in some level. And also, sometimes this attention is called bare, which sometimes means bare of a judgment, bare of stories, just being with direct experience. And Ajahn Tanissaro likes to be provocative. So he said, well, the Buddha never said to pay bare attention. And not only that, there's another word for attention. Manisikara. That's what that means, attention. There's a word called yoniso manisikara, which means wise attention, hence the second part of the name of this talk, wise attention. And wise attention sees things in terms of wise view, which is in terms of the Four Noble Truths. I like to call them four tasks. You know, it's just my hang up about elevating some of these teachings. But I'm not the only person who does that. A lot more reputable people than me use that sort of thing. So wise attention is what we're supposed to do. We're not supposed to bring bare attention. We're supposed to, when we practice, we want to look things in terms of these Four Noble Truths. So then the question gets to be, what's the role of mindfulness? And mindfulness has to do with recalling, recollecting, remembering. And also there's a word that precedes. So the Four Noble Truths are to comprehend dukkha, which usually gets translated as suffering or stress. I'll elaborate on that a little bit. To see its cause. And there's this path, this eightfold path, that that leads to cessation of it, which is a pretty nice message. The end of suffering. Wow. So the word is sama. It sometimes gets translated as right. That usually gets translated right. Sometimes as wise. Sometimes as harmonious. Actually, Ajahn Chah-Nisra uses that translation some. And mindfulness in this Four Noble Truths, which if you really want to think about what mindfulness is, the Four Noble Truths are like the axiomatic. They're the core of this teaching. Everything else fits within that. So if you want to think about what role mindfulness is, think about what role mindfulness plays in these Four Noble Truths. And the role it plays is to remember to give wise attention. It's to practice within the framework of these, to comprehend dukkha, see its cause, and this path to freedom. And it also reminds you, given this view, to form the intention to practice in that direction. So mindfulness in this sense is to keep bringing yourself back to, am I practicing within the framework of the Four Noble Truths? And what that would mean is if you're sitting, you're aware if there's some form of suffering or stress going on. That's the focus. And then to understand what its cause is and to find a way to cessation. So that might raise the question, well, why do I sit here and focus on breathing or trying to develop calm, or sometimes the word is used concentration, within the Eightfold Path? Am I going too fast here? I know I'm saying a lot. Is this clear? So you can read Ajahn Chah-Nisra's article, and he'll fill in some of the blanks for you, I think. But so maybe to come back and summarize, we bring wise attention, looking at things in terms of Four Noble Truths, suffering, cause, path to cessation. And the role of wise mindfulness is to keep that in mind and to act in that direction. Then within the Eightfold Path, and Andrew Olzensky has been giving some talks about this, there's what's called the wisdom factors, ethics. So mindfulness has a role, it's an ethical component to it. So if you're out there being a mindful sniper, that's not quite the Buddhist intention, or being a mindful businessman who is exploiting the heck out of people. It's being used for those kinds of things. But it just totally takes it out of the Buddhist framework. So in the Eightfold Path, there's this group of three things that are sometimes called, it's wise effort, wise concentration, and wise mindfulness. And they work together. So the role mindfulness plays in that is to remember to come back to your object. So when you first come to practice, that's probably enough to take that on. Just remember to bring, whether it's the breathing process, body scans, whatever your technique is, the role of mindfulness is that every time you start wondering about, boy, when I get out of here, I'm really going to have a good time or something, mindfulness is, well, come back to the object right now. And it's certainly beneficial to do that. And actually, concentration is a word, too, that it's the most usual translation of this grouping, but Narayan uses the word collectedness, or also unification gets used, which I think is a little bit better word, because concentration has this kind of tone of trying real hard to focus on something. And if you really want to kind of develop a sense of ease, focusing and trying hard isn't going to do it for you. I was here on Thursday, and there's a guy who's been practicing much longer than I have, and he just creates all this tension because he's been told he needs to concentrate, and he tries so hard. But that's not how you get to quiet the mind down. It's actually bringing qualities of ease and kindness and sort of evenness to things. And there is, just in this whole meditative process, this framework of seeing stress is helpful when you're sitting. because you can kind of say, oh, well, there's some tightness in my body, and maybe if I drop my shoulders a little bit, that'd be better. So that's the framework of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, there's some cause of suffering, which is, when I got rolfed, I don't know if people know anything about rolfing, but rolfing is a way you work with the fascia tissue. And I went to see a rolfer when I was working 80, 90 hours a week and pumped up on coffee. And he did one shoulder, and it was about 4 inches lower. And I thought, well, I hope he does the other one. but that's the kind of tension that's in our bodies. And so we're sitting, we start observing that. And actually directly paying attention to the body, you can say, oh, you know. So that's just some examples of things. Well, I'm going to run out of time. I can see this already. Okay. So, dukkha, usually translated suffering and stress. I revisited what the Buddha says in his discourse on the Four Noble Truths, or allegedly said anyway. And he said, dukkha is old age, sickness, birth is dukkha, old age, sickness, and death is dukkha. Being with people you don't want to be with is dukkha, not being with people you do want to be with is dukkha. Having unpleasant experiences is dukkha. Let's see what else. Sorrow, lamentation, and grief is dukkha. So it's a little, he's sort of covering the bases here. And then he says something that I'm not going to have time to explain tonight, but he says, in short, the five aggregates of clinging are dukkha. So that has to do with looking at what we are as the coming together of things. So aggregates are, we're like a heap of things. And it's just a way of looking. It's not, some science or something, but it's useful. So what are these five aggregates? One is the body. He says, don't cling to the body. Why? Because it's inconstant and unreliable. So when he said, don't cling to it, don't cling to that as what you are. And then he says, feeling tone. Feeling tone is a tricky word, but it just means, is experience pleasant or unpleasant? It could be a physical sensation, it could be an emotional sensation. Don't cling to it, because has anybody arranged to have always pleasant experiences? Because if you do, you got a whole new spiritual practice you can open up. Don't cling to perceptions. Well, what are perceptions? Perceptions are where we recognize something. We generalize. So let me see if I can use an example that wouldn't get you in trouble. Well, one perception would be time. We create a concept of time, and then we create a concept, well, I was like this in the past, and my future is going to be like this, and we create a whole solid entity around this. Or we create some perception about how we're supposed to be, or how other people are supposed to be. They're just concepts, which is why in Zen, it's so much of the effort is just to break through the thinking mind. What got me in this practice, actually, one thing, major thing was thinking will get you nowhere. Well, it does get you somewhere. It gets you in trouble, mostly. It's useful, but we have to realize it's functional, not truth. So we certainly need thought, but we really kind of, we get caught in it and create all kinds of problems with it. Okay. So body, feeling tone, perception, one is a kind of clinging to the sense that you're the knower of all these things. All this is going on and it's sort of me knowing this stuff. The knowing just kind of happens all the time. I mean, when I rang the bell, I didn't ring the bell today, so I wasn't here for a second. I usually am, but I wasn't feeling well, so. But, okay. If I ring the bell, does it take any effort to hear it? None, right? But, but we infer that I'm hearing. That's what the mind does. It infers that there's this old man up here talking a mile a minute about things I don't understand, and I'm here and he's out there. But where's all it happening? It's all happening in the head. There's an image formed in here photons enter the eyes, image gets formed, and the mind infers that there's a distance and that I'm watching. It's all construction. And then the last thing don't cling to are basically thoughts and emotions. And he say, don't cling to these things as what you are because they create dukkha. They are a form of dukkha because they're inconstant and unreliable. And I want to say that that's, it's not that everything is inconstant and unreliable. It's a perception of things. We don't see reality, but we create the notion that there are things in the first place. I know this is kind of pushing things a bit, but there really aren't any things. They're just conditions unfolding moment to moment. There's nothing solid. It's kind of like a rainbow. You know, you could say, well, there's a rainbow over there, but what's a rainbow? It's the coming together of light and moisture, and the same thing of what we are. We're coming together. I could call these aggregates. You could call them a bunch of neurons firing away, charged by sodium and potassium and organs and things like that. You know, there's no real solid you there. And why am I trying to deconstruct this whole sense of solid you is because, I'll get into that a little bit. Okay. So in some sense, this clinging, what is the cause of clinging? Why do we try and grab onto pleasant experiences and push away unpleasant experiences? In some way, we're wired that way, right? There's an inherent, I mean, amoeba would kind of respond to certain things that it perceives as pleasant and be attracted to that and push away unpleasant experiences because it might be dangerous. But this effort to try and make it so there's only pleasant and not unpleasant just doesn't work. And it's not that it doesn't mean that we don't take care of ourselves and try and do things to have a pleasant experience, but we also need to be able to open to difficult experiences. There are times we're just going to get trapped. So anyhow, one of the causes of this the Pali word is tanha. It gets translated as craving. A lot of times people use the word desire as a cause for suffering, but tanha is not like it's pathological. It's a reflex action. You don't decide that, oh, I'm going to have all this aversion, get all upset because I've got an unpleasant physical experience, I've got an unpleasant emotion, and then I'll suffer more. It just happens, right? And tanha leads to clinging. So one tanha is clinging, is craving pleasant sense experiences. There's also a tanha of what's called becoming, of being someone. And so we want to be something solid. We kind of see ourselves as some immaterial entity, and we want to be something solid. So out of a perception of time, we create what I mentioned earlier, a history, which is what? Memory occurring now. And we create a future, which is what? Some projection of what might happen to me in the future. And the likelihood of that projection is right is pretty small, probably. There's actually an interesting study called Stumbling on Happiness. And you know about this, right? And basically what happened was that for the most part, people are terrible at figuring out what's going to make them happy. So that's your projection. If I do all these things, I'll be okay. And the memory part's not accurate either. All kinds of proof that memories don't work. My memory is that I never wavered my practice. My wife has a different memory. Okay. So one way of what we're supposed to do in this practice is that we're supposed to look at these aggregates and notice whether we're clinging to them or not. And the discourse on mindfulness is actually a way to deconstruct that clinging. It gives you a framework of what to look at and let's see. I don't know, help me with my language here. I guess I'll make my own language. Okay, here we go. Yeah. It gives a framework of where and how to pay attention. So, for example, the first part of the discourse on mindfulness is to be mindful of the body. So you sit down and you say, okay, I'm gonna pay attention to the body. And what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to notice all these bodily sensations come and go. And then there's a phrase at the end of there's a refrain that gets stated all the way, 32 times according to Joseph Goldstein. I've never actually counted them. That says, you know, the instructions are always, watch this arise, abide, and pass away. Independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So what is the world? The world is our personal construction, our personal domain. The way we create through our process, our thought process, the way sensory organizations work, that's the world. And he said, don't cling to it. That's the instruction. So that's the practice. So there's body, there's feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You just watch them come and go. And the same thing with thoughts and emotions. Just think of all the thoughts you've had today. Where are they? All the drama. And the same thing is true of emotions. So why practice like this? Well, because it creates a sense of dispassion about it. You start saying, oh, yeah, yesterday, and I just worry about this person, and now it's gone. And you start seeing that, and there's a dispassion. So that's a lot about what the practice is about, to see that these perceptions we have about what reality is are ephemeral. They come and they go. I was with Joseph Goldstein at one point where I was just doing impermanence. That was my practice for a couple months. And, you know, you don't get a whole lot of excitement there. The big excitement is a mealtime and a shower, maybe. And so we have these really good meals, and at the end I'd notice, like, that was really good, maybe I'll have another bite. And I'd have another bite, and how long did that last? Not very long. Or, I said, well, we're not going to have it. How long did desire for that go? Not very long. So knowing things are like that kind of develops a sense of dispassion. And it doesn't mean apathetic. It really is a quality of being open, of kind of balance about things. And when you actually start seeing how you don't cling to things, life is vibrant. Things are just, you know, the more settled the mind is, the less it's kind of up in this conceptual. It's just amazing. I was sitting here and looking at these the wind blowing the leaves out there and how the lighting is changing. So that's really practices in part, just taking these five aggregates and seeing if you're clinging to them. If you are, you can bet that there's suffering going on. So a good question, you know, on a day and you're all upset about something is ask what you're clinging to. Some thoughts, some emotions, some view of what you are, that sort of thing. Okay. So I'll give you a couple examples of this. It's useful at one level to know that this stuff's impermanent, but when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't help so much sometimes. So I want to tell two stories. A guy in my elders group, he had a heart attack, and he drove himself to the doctor. And the surgeon said, do you know you're having a heart attack? And he said, who's having a heart attack? Because he wasn't claiming the body is him. And he didn't say it out loud because he knew the surgeon would probably think he's nutso. But he really talked about how free it felt. That the body's just doing this right now. Or I have a wonderful dental hygienist. I like her a lot. And believe me, I stick with people like that because I really have one that kind of went downhill after a while. And I don't know about you, but I was getting my teeth cleaned. It's not a particularly pleasant experience, but it's not always unpleasant. And so I was there, and you know, you sort of have some pain, and then they have this music in the background. And they're playing Mac the Knife. How many people know that song? Yeah, all the people with gray hair. You're your exception there. But, you know, I just laughed. I thought, are you kidding me? That's the 60s, right? You know? And that was the last version. That was Frank Sinatra's version was in the 60s, I guess. So you kind of see these. You start seeing, like, And actually, a lot of the practice with pain and things like that is to see how the mind contracts around and makes it something solid. Okay, so that's one tack, seeing the impermanence of things. And there's a lot of skill around how to be with difficult experiences, but I just don't have to. Maybe we can do that in Q&A tonight if that comes up. But I guess I got about 15 minutes left, so I got to switch a little bit. So wise view in part is to see that clinging to these things causes suffering and to kind of develop a dispassion for it. And I want to say, actually, part of what I'm offering here is one particular way of looking at practice. And it's very subject-object oriented, right? There's a you watching all this stuff come and go. Or that's a sense of something is back there watching. There's a guy, Ajahn Sumedho, who, I don't know, probably in his 90s now, founded a couple of monasteries in England and long-term, you know, really a monk that people really look up to. And he said, really thought insight meditation focused too much on objects. Because you don't really ever get free of self as you keep thinking you're the person watching all this stuff. There's a split. So he said, so another question is to ask yourself, well, what's aware of all this? To focus on the awareness, to notice the knowing just happens. The bell rings and there's a knowing of it. And that, you know, so that's very free. I have a guy who's taking a couple of classes with me. He's still sending me emails about what is this awareness stuff. The problem is it's experiential. So you can't, it's just out of the ordinary concept of things. So it's very difficult to explain. But in a way, it's what's there when you're not pushing things away or trying to get somewhere. So I thought at the end we'd do a little exercise to play with that. So in the Eightfold Path, there's this wisdom factor, there are ethics, and this collectedness or concentration, these three components to it. And the wisdom factor has two parts to it. One part is that you see all this stuff's impermanent, and you kind of see it's like all dreamlike. There's a real freeing from it. So here's the word freedom. The freedom is kind of disidentifying of all these aggregates as what you are. Or seeing that maybe there's this quality of awareness that's at peace no matter what. And so that's a technique, either being focused on just knowing the quality of awareness or seeing these changing nature of things. And that's like for ultimate freedom in a way. Then there's another aspect of it, which has to do with a word karma, which is a very loaded word. People do all kinds of things with it. Different traditions argue about it. It's probably as bad, if not worse, than mindfulness. But I think a useful way to think of karma are habitual patterns of behavior. And what we do is we identify these habitual patterns as this is what we are. So I'm, you know, maybe you don't say anything more. So then you say, well, I'm a shy person, but it's just a learned way of being. Or I'm an angry person because I'm always, but that's a learned way. It's conditioned. And there, so a lot of practice and part of the reason the ethics is there is develop what I would call, what actually is called bright karma. This is in our very much relative world. And I think this is something that is much more accessible than kind of seeing this through this whole identity thing. And the idea with karma is to look in a really holistic way, you know, what the heart senses, what the body feels like, of how your actions affect how you feel. And so the practice is to develop bright karma. To actually cultivate them. That's why some people do loving kindness practice or something like that. But not do it because you're supposed to, but really pay attention. When you're kind to other people, what's it feel like? When you're compassionate, what's it feel like? When you don't want things so much, what does it feel like? That's quality of lack of greed. And so you start seeing that wow, this brings a quality of connectedness, of openness, of ease, of uplifting. And there's a natural inclination to start doing this. Okay? And then there's dark karma, which You know, it can be anything from anger, depression, whatever. And part of the practice is opening to that, being with these things, because a lot of stuff's embodied. So for me, for example, I had a real defender part of me. That's a they're also like little programs, if you want to think of it, that are parts of you. So I had a defender because of things happened to me. And sometimes just rage would come up over stupid stuff. And so the practice is sometimes being able to sit with that, and it gets released out of the body. So that's another framework for practice, is cultivating bright karma, releasing dark karma. And you can play with those. So a lot of metta practice is about that, or compassion practice is about that. There's a teacher who was very well known. There's a book written by all his about a lot of his, whether they're his talks he gave, named Shunryu Suzuki. And he has a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And he gave a talk one time that started, I have no idea what the talk was like. I bought the book just to find out what he said in the talk, and all the book says that he started to talk this way. And the talk was, each of you is perfect just the way you are. And there's room for improvement. And what a way to look at yourself. That you're a result of causes and conditions. You got born into this world with a set of genes, a group of parents, or maybe two parents, I don't know. And things happen to you, culture, and things happen to you, and you're just the way you are. You couldn't be any other way. So that's the sense in which you're perfect. And the room for improvement is, well, you have a little wiggle room to change. You can step out of this habitual way of living. So you start seeing what places, what ways you behave that cause unnecessary suffering and stressing, and you start forming a little intention to maybe pause and behave in a different way and see how it works for you. So that's the perfect part. And then it's to bring this effort of trying to sort of shift these patterns, not change who you are, but I think you can bring, for me, you can bring a lot more compassion to this and some patience to it. It's not like you can just will that you're going to be different all of a sudden, because these patterns have been, you know, depending on your age, they're pretty well embedded. One thing I actually do, that create bright karma, is I look at everybody, every one of you, and think, oh, you're all perfect just the way you are. And then I just say, may you be well. I do that when I go to the store. And it just feels good. It's just a better way to be in the world. So, apologize for spinning through this, but it's a lot of material. And, you know, the particular topic was picked because the center suggested I give a talk on this, since I'm teaching a course that started today at noon from 10:30 to 12. And then we have lunch together. So you've heard more than I said in the class today. So if you're interested and have some time free during the day, we'd love to have you join us. This is a great group. So what I'd like to do is end with a little exercise. And it's going to be pretty brief, but just sit in a relaxed position and just say to yourself, I am sitting here. Now drop the here, so just I am sitting. Now drop the sitting and just say I am. Now drop the am and just say I. Now drop the I. So without thinking, just sensing what it's like. Just staying in the body. and just feel what it's like if there's no problem to solve, nowhere to get to, nothing to get rid of, nothing to get. And so the hearing happened all on its own, didn't it? So I apologize. I know I said a lot tonight, but just to give you some framework about really what we're doing in this practice and some, you know, we're in, maybe to summarize things a little bit. One part of practice is just to notice body, heart, mind, feeling tone, and just seeing its impermanent nature. And the intention of that is just to create some dispassion to it. And it's something that gets very deep after a while. You know, it's like you do a little bit and, you know, and after a while you just start seeing all, it's just, and it's not like you don't care. It's just like there's this, oh, wow, look at this. It's amazing just how vibrant the world is. And then the other aspect of practice is to create bright patterns. Not to see these things as what you are, but see them as patterns, the way you've been conditioned. It's not your fault. And you can change them. Okay? So on that note, I'll just bring it to an end. It's just been a delight to spend the evening with you. I hope you'll all be free, at least sometimes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.